And welcome to another episode of They Came From the North, the controversially Canadian podcast where each week we discuss a director's body of work, some well-known, some lesser well-known. So, as usual, with me we have from the land of fish and fog, Newfoundland, Mr. Steve Power.
Mr. Power. Tonight, I am Mr. Power.
And Mr. The John Mercer.
Too much joke.
Just dirt. Too much joke. Friends.
My intro is gone. I quit.
I'm done with you guys professionally.
From the land of petroleum and dinosaurs, we have Mr. Andrew Forbes.
Diesel T-Rex.
Dinosaurs are effing rad.
And myself, Gabriel Girard, coming from the land of poutine and whining.
And many banging pots and pans these days.
And apparently male model porn stars who like to send severed body parts to the House of Parliament.
I just like to, before we really get into it, I just have to say, as you touched on that, Steve, I have to tip my hat to the Sun Media Corporation for reaching a new level of classiness when they ran the headline, Natural Porn Killer.
Man, that sounds like a Gregory Dark movie. Video, excellent bronze, natural porn killer.
So this week we're discussing director Stuart Gordon, E of Reanimator fame. Gordon begins as an anthropology major in the University of Wisconsin, but then quickly changed to theater classes. From the beginning of his theater organization, he was steeped in controversy when he did a Peter Pan adaptation that was very political and sexual. He did a lot of theater before moving into film, doing such things as Mamet plays and comedies. And then he joined forces with Charles Band and the Empire Pictures to do their first big hit for both Gordon and Empire Pix, Reanimator, starring Jeffrey Combs and Barbara Crampton. The same team then got together again to do From Beyond, another Lovecraft adaptation, quickly followed by Dolls, which was filmed in Italy and is kind of a quirky fairy tale horror film. After that, they did the science fiction film Robot Jocks, more or less a Transformers pick before the time. Then the Inquisition picture The Pit and the Pendulum, starring Lance Henriksen. A science fiction film Fortress, starring Christopher Lambert. Another sci-fi film called Space Truckers. A rarely seen and hard to find Ray Bradbury children's story adaptation called The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit. That's for the 90s, mostly low budget pictures. And then starting in 2001, he started a more serious evolution, I'd say, in his career, starting with Dagon, another Lovecraft adaptation, the nihilistic killer film King of the Ants, the David Mamet adaptation Edmund, starring William H. Macy, and finally the movie Stuck, based on a true story where a guy gets stuck in the windshield of a girl's car, starring Stephen Ray and Mena Suvari. And since then, he hasn't done anything much except an episode of the TV series Fear Itself. Rumors of a Reanimator follow-up keep popping up, but it never happens, and there's nothing else on his resume so far. So do you guys want to chime in on his career before we get into the good, bad, and the ugly, or?
Well, Yeah, I guess I would just say that I think Reanimator follow-up rumors are sort of in the same category as Evil Dead 4.
And Ghostbusters 3.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's something that maybe the fires are stoked by wishful thinking.
Or if it happens, it's going to be Yuzna directing again, probably, since he did two other sequels. So let's go. As usual, we'll start with the good, which is either the film that we feel is his best flick or just our favorite of the bunch. So let's start with Steve.
I've definitely got to go with Dagon for this one.
Oh.
I'm a Lovecraft nut, and I have been since maybe junior high. And Dagon, as bad as the first act is, like as bad as the roll up to the main story is, and I mean it's pretty bad. It's, you know, it feels like an Italian cheap, you know, like spaghetti horror, I guess, you know, and the actors are horrible and such. But once it gets rolling, once it really gets into the meat of the Lovecraft story, which is not, I don't think it's a literal adaptation, if I remember correctly, because it's been a long time since I read Dagon. I think it's actually more a different story, a different Lovecraft story. The name escapes me, but I'm sure there are horror freaks out there that'll tell me. But it really did a great job of feeling, you know, Lovecrafty. And as far as adaptations of Lovecraft's work go, it really nailed that creepy, you know, that hidden terror kind of vibe perfectly. I thought
the isolated coastal vibe. Yeah,
you know, yeah. Kind of like it was Innsmouth. It, you know, it was New England, only instead of New England, it was like coastal Italy or Spain.
I mean, the only movie I've seen that even comes close to capturing the same kind of Lovecraftian existential dread is Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah, definitely. And it almost has kind of a Carpenter vibe at times, but it does, you know, it differentiates itself just enough, and it doesn't really feel like it doesn't feel like a derivative work. Like even when I look at Reanimator, and I know Reanimator kind of comes from the same era and isn't quite related to, but I still can't escape comparing it to Evil Dead 2 or Evil Dead. Like it's still got that, you know. Whereas Dagon really feels just like a unique picture. It really feels like something that, you know, Gordon really wanted to kind of knock that Lovecraftian adaptation out of the park, you know?
Well, nobody was doing those in 2001.
No, I mean, even now, like, nobody ever really did a good Lovecraft adaptation, you know?
Yeah,
and actually, getting on to that, Gordon always comes across to me as, you know, he genuinely loves the H.P. Lovecraft books.
Oh, he is all over Lovecraft's work.
And like, his Dreams in the Witch House, I believe, is called his episode of Masters of Horror. One of the better offerings from season one, right?
Yeah, and but that was another example of him kind of, like, overcoming budget constraints and stuff, you know?
And I think Dagon actually benefits, getting back on to, you know, when you're saying comparing it to Reanimator.
Yeah.
Dagon benefits from two things. One, the complete lack of Charles Band. And two, I think it also benefits with, you know, having come out in 2001 so late in Gordon's career.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, he's a much more mature filmmaker.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. He was able to rein in ambitions and stuff, you know. And I mean, now
and it's less jokey and like over the top gore. It's more really more a straight horror flick than.
Although it has its share.
It does,
for sure.
One,
I mean,
one scene in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Stuart Gordon flick. You'll always have that dark humor in there.
Yeah. What's his record now for gallons of blood? Because I know prior to Reanimator, he used to say he'd never use more than 2 gallons of fake blood, and then that used 24, and I think he's been ramping it up with every horror movie. I know, like, Gordon loves, you know, having somebody thrown up against a wall, and when they bounce off, there's just a smear where their head hit.
Or when a cat is thrown against a wall.
Oh, dude,
that was my favorite moment.
My wife walked in the room when I was watching that last night, and her reaction was hilarious. not so much for the horrid puppet cat the 2 seconds before that, but just when it hits the wall, you get that like sickening slurp noise.
And I have to add that usually the makeup effects in his movies are pretty impressive too. The CGI in Dagon is kind of shoddy,
yeah,
but the makeups are good.
It's 2001 low-budget CGI, but I mean, this is a guy who has always had some skill for hiding the constraints of his budget.
There's one shot early on that it, to be perfect, I mean, the fact that it's in the midst of the worst part of the movie doesn't help it, but it's an underwater shot and it really feels like a 1998 like submarine simulator graphic. And so that throws me a bit out of the movie for a couple of minutes, but to be honest, that's really the only, I'd remembered it as worse than it was. That's
am
really
I
the
watching,
only.
Am I watching Crash part. Dive? Where's Michael Dudikoff?
No, it's like, it really nails that dread, you know, it just feels Lovecraftian, for lack of a better word. You know, it's got that whole, that mythos feel, you know, Lovecraft and August Derleth and these guys, you know, it's totally soaked in that classic Cthulhu, you know. That's
icy fingers right around the base of your cerebellum, and you just can't shake the feeling.
Yeah, and I mean, and in spite of the cheesiness, you know, like some of the makeup effects are pretty bad, the CG, a lot of the acting. In spite of that, the movie still works.
Yeah, one has to wonder how better it would have been if Jeffrey Combs had done the role instead of Gordon, who is kind of bleh.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. I always, you guys, I don't know if anyone remembers this. I used to own Dagon, and I picked it up for work when I, you know, first got my PS2 and got into collecting DVDs. And I don't know what it looked like to the rest of the world, but I remember in Canada it had this, you know, the cover. It looked like a cover photo from Fangoria magazine. It was just horrible makeup shot of some Monster Man's face, right?
I think that's
like Barlow from Salem's Lot mixed
from
with
Salem's
Sarlacc
Lot, yeah.
And I think that was the same version I had.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a photo on IMDb.
So yeah, that's mine. I definitely got to go with Dagon.
So, John, what's yours?
I'm going to backpedal a little bit. We're going to stay on the Lovecraft train, and just because I watched it last night, I'm going to go with Reanimator. Woo. Or, sorry, H.P. Lovecraft's Reanimator.
Yes. Damn it.
As the title effect says, when the most 1980s score in history starts.
That's Ben.
I thought I was watching Night of the Demons for a second.
Richard Band, right?
Yeah.
Combined with a pretty affectionate psycho homage.
Yeah.
I have to say.
But I got to say, guys, you know, Steve said it pretty good a few seconds ago, how it's, you know, it's kind of got that whole, it really feels like it would be one of the Raimi and Co. movies. But it was a lot better than I had remembered it. I used to hold it in that same regard as cheesy schlock like Evil Dead. But it's got a couple things that kind of elevate it to me. Jeffrey Combs, creepy as fuck. You know, and this is a guy, like, I didn't even realize it at first, but I was listening to it, and I was typing something down on my laptop, and I wasn't looking at the screen for a second, and just not seeing his, you know, because he's the type of guy that voice should not come out of that body.
Mm-hmm.
They're not seeing him on screen and hearing his voice, and it finally dawned on me, that was the Scarecrow from Batman.
It was.
Yeah. And
from Batman the Animated Series.
Batman the Animated Series, and I believe he also played the Question on Justice League.
I never made that connection.
But you really hear the scene when he goes in to rent the room from Dan and his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
You can really hear it there. But you know, you got Combs' just subtle creepiness, and it's got a much more interesting look than 99.9% of horror movies made during that mid to late 80s period. It really elevates it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
just the way the reanimator fluid glows.
Yeah. And I mean, you can make the argument that Gordon pretty much throws whatever shots and camera moves that he can think of at the screen to see what sticks. I mean, you're getting like Dutch angles pop up once or twice in the movie and then never again. There's a really cool, almost like a deep focus shot when the female lead is walking down the hallway while there's a, you know, towards one of the more gruesome reanimation scenes.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this was, you know, his first full-length feature, so he was obviously at the point where he was experimenting and, you know, young and full of energy and trying to do whatever he could.
He was still in his 40s, I think.
Yeah.
But, like, there's just something to it. Underneath all of those, like, all that experimentation and everything, there's just this palpable zeal for the material. You can tell this is like you hear the stories about how he had never read Herbert West Reanimator because it was out of print and he had to go dig for it at the Chicago Public Library. And you can tell this is a guy who genuinely loved those stories.
The teeth were sunk in.
Yeah.
You know, by all involved, it really felt like they were all really heavily invested.
Yeah, and he's got this tangible drive to just to transcend the boundaries of being the simple shitty splatter horror movie. He really wanted that to be something more. And I mean, you know, like the gore isn't quite as elaborate as, you know, you'd see from Rob Bottin or Rick Baker. It's nowhere near as indulgent as Tom Savini. It's really effective and it's really, really gruesome at times. Gabe brought up, you know, the glowing reagent. And I still love that, man. That's a great special effect.
I just like the professor's head. Ooh. I mean, that's pretty impressive, too, that it just moves on its own and even tries to do some cunnilingus in there.
That for though, man. Like, all the different rigs they had him jammed into.
Is that a euphemism?
Yeah.
Because I remember one thing he was jammed into.
Oh, that's rich.
That's what he said.
I like Reanimator. You know, I used to compare it to stuff like Evil Dead or Evil Dead 2, but you want to know something? It's better than both.
Yeah. And, you know, as much as of a cult figure Bruce Campbell is and as much as I like him, I think Jeffrey Combs is actually probably maybe a better actor.
Maybe.
Yeah, definitely. Quite a bit,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to jump the queue here and say that my good is also Reanimator, because I don't want to lose his momentum. It's the kind of movie that it evokes this really sort of potent feeling of unease throughout the whole thing. Going back to Frankenstein, which obviously this owes a lot to, the whole idea of, you know, do I want to do this science? Is it crossing a boundary? That sort of tension between I want to see where this goes and also this is sort of crossing a line. It gets that perfectly, combined with, I mean, Gordon, you know, he may have wanted to make something better than your average splatter flick, but he definitely also knows that he has to deliver in certain, you know, certain departments that are expected of that audience. I mean, the scene, there's a scene where, you know, they sneak into the morgue and inject this stuff into, I guess he's like a bodybuilder that had died from heart failure or something.
Oh, the 12-hour corpse.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's kind of just like an indulgent horror movie gore moment, but there's still something really inventive about the way they end up dispatching him. And it's got that kind of like old school special effects craft that it feels a lot more substantial than some newer stuff. And, you know, they kind of linger on some of the unpleasantness and it's good.
It just,
I like
it
that.
Feels more weighty. It feels,
well,
yeah.
I'd say that in general, unease is something that Gordon is very good at doing.
Not quite as cartoonishly over the top as Raimi. It's more of a ew.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the thing with Raimi is I find him it's impossible to take his horror seriously. Personally,
he's just like, so much of a Three Stooges fan.
Like, I love Evil Dead 2. I have gained a new respect recently for the first Evil Dead, which is certainly more of a straight horror movie. But, you know, Raimi really wants to have his cake and eat it too, in terms of, you know, trying to get scares and throwing comedy in. But, you know, Gordon sort of knows when to move from one to the other. And I think he ends up getting a much more sort of effective gallows humor from that, mm-hmm. instead of just deflating the horror and deflating the humor by trying to mix the two.
I think Gordon is more of just a straight up effective horror director than Raimi is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. And his, I also think Gordon's sense of humor, kind of like we were talking with John Landis, that was last week.
When we were
talking about Landis, you know, whenever there is comedy in there, it's black as pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, talk about, yeah. you know, throwing that cat against the wall.
Yeah, I mean, at one point you got, like, this hilarious cat puppet, and you got to, like...
Also just...
the girl's reaction to the scene before, but, man, then when he throws that cat, that thing goes off like a water balloon full of chum. And then, of course, then you get Herbert West's reaction to it, which is, you know, pretty much how Mr. Spock would react to it.
Yeah, he just kind of raises an eyebrow.
Yeah. It's just like this look of, I don't know if it's logic or just, you know, abject cruelty.
Like, huh.
Yeah. And, you know, like, and I've read Herbert West's Reanimator. You know, I went back when I first started hanging out with Steve and the boys, when that was my introduction to Lovecraft. And, you know, Coombs really did get that character. You know, just, you said it pretty well yourself, Andrew. You know, he's kind of like a more unscrupulous Victor von Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He
doesn't pretend any... sort of nobility.
There's no nobility. There's no
anyone who doesn't really understand it, but he also knows Sorry?
I don't even think, like, there's the arguments later on in the movie, you know, about what was the other doctor's name? Hill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the arguments about using West's work to become famous. I don't think West wants to be famous. I just think he wants to see where the equation goes.
I think it's all about ego, man.
Yeah,
it's all about just the knowledge. Like,
oh, he's very he's very, very arrogant and very narcissistic too. Yeah.
I still love the "I gave him life."
Yeah. You killed him. No.
I also think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that the I mean, really, you know, Jeffrey Combs is the star of this, but the protagonist is played by Bruce Abbott, who is the third and least part in the Elias Koteas, Christopher Maloney, Bruce Abbott trifecta. And it often throws me when I watch this movie. I have to remind myself that I'm not looking at one of them.
You have to remind yourself that this isn't The Prophecy.
Yeah.
And before I move on to my good, I just have to add that I actually liked Bride of Reanimator too. That's Brian Usna directed it, but it's very inventive as well. There's a lot of, like,
but not beyond Reanimator, Gabe, right?
No, Beyond sucks.
That was the alternative title.
Which one came with the glow of the dark injector pin on DVD?
I think that was like the collector's edition of the first
one. Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
Usnev was actually a producer on a lot of Gordon's flick and went on to his own directing career, but it's not as interesting.
No.
He won't be getting
We'll be dealing with the Brian Usnev episode in approximately 7 years.
If we have to watch Faust, Love of the Dime, I'm going to kill myself.
We won't be doing that episode because at least 3 out of 4 of us will have killed ourselves.
So for my good, just to make it a little bit different, I picked The Pit and The Pendulum.
Yay!
There's going to be fisticuffs.
Fisticuffs! That 10% is coming for you tonight, Andrew Forbes.
which really, I mean, I'd add it to the unease column for Gordon. This movie is all about feeling, making the spectator feel uneasy about what he's witnessing. It's about the Inquisition and this girl who decides to go against it and gets arrested as a witch, and the Grand Inquisitor Torquemada, played by the always amazing Lance Henriksen, falls in love.
Creepy as shit, Lance Henriksen.
Oh man,
the man who doesn't. I don't know if he doesn't know when to quit or if he just like has no idea when movie seasons suck.
I think he's just batshit insane.
Yeah, that's
probably.
The man does not have. Yeah. He does not have an off switch.
I mean, and that's. I mean, in that movie, is probably the creepiest I've ever seen, with the shaved head and the few tufts of hair.
I want to let you in on a secret, John. Lance Henriksen has actually just been followed around by a film crew for his entire adult life, and they just sort of edit together.
Insane. Gary Busey's a joke.
But yeah, I really liked the recreation of the Middle Ages. It feels very honest, even despite the very low budget. I mean, you can feel the grime and the stink of it.
I can afford to watch the sets in between takes, man.
And also, I mean, there's the fact that the Inquisition would arrest people who were midwives and, you know, just medicine women and torture them. And their general cruelty and disdain for human life is very well portrayed. I thought the main actress was actually pretty good in it. She's never played in anything else, but she's got this like doe-eyed Isabel Adjani kind of thing going on.
You know, I don't want to tip my hand too early, but this isn't my good. But having said that, I agree. I think the main actress is probably one of the best parts of it. She definitely feels very genuine and she knows how to play that role.
Yeah.
And it also features Frances Bay, the Marble Rye woman.
And Oliver Reed as the Cardinal.
Excuse me. Oliver Reed and how many bottles of whiskey as the Cardinal?
He was out of whiskey, man. He started drinking Elizabeth Taylor's cologne again.
I like to think that the scene when he arrives and, you know, Lance Henriksen keeps giving him wine, that was just Oliver Reed stumbling onto the set and Lance Henriksen trying to placate him so that he didn't get his head ripped off.
Am I in a movie?
More of the prop wine.
Excuse me, Mr. Reed. I never said I knew you. I said you touched me.
And, something I'd like to add to is it's probably his first movie where you see his more serious side pop up. There's some dark gallows humor in there, but it's less jokey as his previous films. Although it begins with like the Inquisition gets like digging up the skeleton and whipping it. I mean, that's probably like the most ridiculous jokey part of the movie to me.
Yeah, that part didn't really make a lot of sense.
That part was actually the part that I thought was the most effective in the movie. And, you know, and it's not that I saw it and I didn't think, oh, this is ridiculous, because I did. But as the scene played out, and we should probably explain it, you know, as the movie opens, a grave is uncovered and a skeleton is pulled out, and we're, you know, informed by Torquemada that, you know, because of his sins, he has to be punished. And despite the fact that this is this desiccated skeleton, he's still strung up in ropes in front of his family and various nobles and flogged until the pieces fall apart, and then the pieces are flogged some more. And it's ridiculous, but at the same time, I kind of felt that was the most like psychologically interesting, if extremely unsubtle, sort of explanation, and a really good way to open it, sort of saying that you know, Lance Henriksen's character, Torquemada, is so obsessed with this idea of punishing people that it doesn't even occur to him that the fact that this guy is dried out and a skeleton, you know, that he shouldn't still be flogged.
I think it's more, I think that scene really, in the way it plays out, is almost more intended to show how far he's willing to go to intimidate other people as well. Like,
and that's the other part of it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this guy's son and his wife are there, and we're informed that, you know, because of his sins, all of his wealth is forfeit to the church or to the Inquisition. And, you know, this is essentially, you know, it's a racket, but at the same time, the fact that he's doing that shows that he's more blind to the fact that he's using it as a racket. He still genuinely believes in this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I found that the character of Torquemada was pretty interesting. I mean, he's a pretty complex creation. The scene that comes back to me is when they're examining the witch for signs, the young woman, and they get her naked, and you'd see the Jeffrey Combs and these other guys just pawing at her, and like, he gets angry. He's like, this isn't, like, the circus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This isn't, we're not doing this for fun, guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One almost gets the sense, though, given how that plays out, that it may be more jealousy on his part.
Yeah, true. That's true.
Than actually thinking that this is inappropriate. But, yeah, I mean, he's a true believer, but he's also indulgent, and then willing to, of course, you know, blame anyone and everyone other than himself for his own feelings.
And he's certifiably insane too,
because he also built the titular device of the movie.
Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is, you know, more evidence to the whole batshit insane side of him.
And the fact that he's, the fact that he sleeps with a sword dangling above his head.
Mm-hmm. The most insane thing about him, though, is that he has that, you know, impeccably trimmed monk's haircut, and then there are like three hairs at the front that he missed. The whole movie.
But earlier, Andrew mentioned Dutch angles, and they're all over this picture.
Yeah.
That was John. I can't take credit for bringing in Dutch angles. I was trying to tone down the film speak.
Oh, okay. Then John. Sorry, John.
For our stupider listeners.
For all the rest of you, those are tilter cams.
When he turns that dark camera sideways, right?
But yeah, I mean,
I
thought basically it was a very interesting picture, both like enjoyable and at the same time making you very uneasy. And it has some interesting sides to show about the Inquisition without getting too much into like the torture porn aspect of it.
Eli Roth, take note.
Well, we're going to be coming back to this, so I can't say too much more about it.
Okay, well, that's
the gird your loins.
That's the best place to seg you into our bad, I guess. Just to remind you that our bad is not a quote unquote bad movie. It's just a movie that we don't really care for, or a movie that could be good if it didn't have so many flaws.
Or that we kind of like, but think it definitely has crappy moments.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this time let's start with, well, Andrew.
Oh, well, then you're not going to have to wait. I was going to make Pit and the Pendulum My Ugly, but I've kind of been swayed, I have to say, by our discussion in the last few minutes. So I'm upgrading it to bad.
What was more, bad originally?
More, I'm going to say, traditionally bad, as opposed to, you know, has a few flaws. I genuinely think it's a bad movie. It has some good things going to it. We've discussed that. But to be perfectly honest,
God, Montresor.
I thought the tone, I didn't think that Gordon really controlled the tone very well. I thought he handled the cast pretty poorly. Lance Henriksen is an actor who, he's got a great presence. I like him a lot. But unless you have someone I don't know, James Cameron seems to know how to direct him.
Yeah, Lance, knock it off or I'm going to punch you.
Yeah, Chris Carter, obviously, in Millennium, and the tone of that show helped a lot.
Watch me punch his cameraman.
You know, Chris Carter with Millennium knew how to handle him, but if you have someone who doesn't, I guess, maybe have the best handle on how to direct actors, and I would put Stuart Gordon in that category.
How about you, Drew?
You get him into the 10, the 11, maybe even breaking the Spinal Tap scale, going up to 12. And it's kind of a problem that goes across the whole cast because it really feels – this is a movie where everybody thinks they're the main character, I think, and play that way. You know, a movie's supporting cast has to recognize when it is a supporting cast.
Except for her husband, who just is not there at all.
Well, no, he's trying. You know, he's bad at it, but he's trying.
I'm Oliver Reed, damn it.
Oliver Reed's in it for about 2 minutes, but I think he gives the best performance in it.
And Jeffrey Combs, of course, upstages all his moments.
Jeffrey Combs is good in it, but at the same time, he doesn't have a lot to work with. And I don't know, Lance Henriksen, I hated him in this. Like, he was so indulgent in his performance.
Well,
I hate Pacino in Scarface. It's the same situation.
He's like Robert Loggia in Innocent Blood.
except there's one key difference. Robert Loggia was playing a character who was having a ball. And Lance Henriksen isn't.
He's playing a torture maniac.
He's playing a guy who hates himself and hates everyone else, and he's constantly miserable. But, there'd always be, some situation where somebody was doing something and he walks into the scene and tells them to stop. This happens, 8 times in the movie. And it's always, stop! The Inquisition does not want this. He irritated me.
We lost.
You know what would have been awesome in it? The Name of the Rose. F. Murray Abraham played the Inquisitor in that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That would have been awesome in Pit in the Pendulum.
Yeah. He was that kind of, slimy, you just wanted to punch that guy. And don't get me wrong, I wanted to punch Lance Henriksen. But not in the same way. I wanted to punch the actor, not the character. However, I would like to say Frances Bay, the Marble Rye woman, she was kind of awesome in this. I don't think she actually gave, what I would qualify as a great performance. However, she did stuff herself full of gunpowder and turn herself into a human grenade.
Which was awesome.
And that deserves some credit.
Which was awesome.
That was one of the all-time great horror movie deaths I've ever seen. And I have to tip my hat to that.
When her remains hit the wall, did she leave a bloody smear?
Her bones impaled everyone around her.
Yeah, she was basically a big shrapnel bomb.
Yeah. She made herself into a nail bomb.
I'm going on Amazon right now.
It was kind of
it sounds like swordfish, but it doesn't suck.
She plays this weird kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of character, who when Maria, the innocent sort of main character lady, is taken in and put on trial as being a witch, she has this sort of mini training sequence where she goes into the spirit world, and Frances Bay is sort of one, she's just almost at the point of saying, use the force at the end of the movie in a disembodied voice. And that I found just completely absurd and out of place. It could have worked in a pre-Star Wars world, but it really plays like Obi-Wan Kenobi in a world where Star Wars exists. And, that was just another example to me of Stuart Gordon not being able to control the tone of this movie. Mm-hmm. A lot of the scenes that were supposed to play as particularly dramatic either felt flat or felt goofy. The supposed heroic character, I guess you'd say, the swashbuckling hero, is played by, I guess, the world's most successful piece of Melba toast. This guy has zero charisma. Stuart Gordon can't direct action to save his life. I decided.
He really can't.
And so, you know, there are a couple of scenes involving...
More on that in a minute.
Yeah. involving some fights that just feel like, you know, the disused footage from an episode of Xena. incidentally, these
There's
take place in the ultimate torture room where we have the, you know, titular pendulum, which looks like it was decorated by, you know, the caterer's son who has a wicked van. And, you know, it's basically, it's like medieval van art on the walls. It's like skeletons in carriages, but obviously done with airbrushing. And it just looks terrible.
Well, you haven't seen Elvira's Antedales, have you?
No, is yeah, it? I missed that one.
Oh, man. Anyways, there's the bit in the pendulum in there, and it's pretty bad.
I'm gonna jump in now.
And one more thing. Mark Margolis, who's sort of one of those characters that you see pop up in all kinds of things, look him up, you know, you'll recognize his face. But when he first showed up in this movie, I would have bet $10 that they've gotten Dario Argento to play a role in this movie. The stringy black hair. Anyway, go on, Steve.
I'm going to jump in as well. I'm going to skip the line because the pit in the pendulum is also my choice for bad. I will say right out of the gate, I saw this movie when it was released on home video. It was one of those things that, you know, sitting on a video store shelf. That looks kind of cool. And we actually rented both versions of it at the same time. We rented the old, I don't even remember what year, but it was
Vincent Price.
Vincent Price, yeah.
And 61.
Yeah, we rented that one, and we rented the Stuart Gordon version. It was myself and my buddy Mike. And
speaking of, like, video covers, this definitely had that, like, awesome, I want to rent this.
Oh,
like,
did it ever?
Julian it Sands in Warlock look, you know?
And this is why we rented it.
Oh, how many people fell into the Warlock trap? That looks badass.
We put the tape in, and we saw Full Moon Entertainment, I think it was. And it was like, oh, no. But we
went to a Full Moon picture, and it's not called Trancers.
Yeah, this is bad.
Or Puppet Master.
Yeah, this is bad. This is very bad. But in spite, like, against all odds, we actually really enjoyed it. And it's one, I was a lawbreaker, even in my youth. We had two VCRs hooked up, and we used to dub off VHS cassettes all the time, like while we were watching.
Authorities have been notified.
FBI warning. Walmart. Thankfully, it's not CIA warning, or I'd be in trouble. But, no, it was one we watched repeatedly. It was one, you know, we'd put on every so often and sit down and watch. And I enjoyed it for, you know, being like a medieval period film kind of thing, like and a medieval period horror film, which is not something you saw a lot of. But man, those production values were bad.
Yeah.
You know, it really does feel like a TV show. It really does feel like, you know, Saturday night sci-fi movie of the week kind of thing, you know?
But I mean that despite maybe not quite capturing the tone, Gordon still gives it a ton of atmosphere.
And I think the big problem I have with The Pit and the Pendulum, and especially compared to the original, it's not dark looking enough, if that makes any sense to you. It's too bright.
Lots of daytime.
Yeah, it's too brightly lit. I mean, you look at Reanimator. Reanimator's a dark, dark film. You know, there's a lot of black in that movie. But this was just, it was really bright and cheerful. And even the old Vincent Price one was considerably darker. And that really affects the tone.
Well, I think
Roger Corman. Holy shit!
I think he maybe was going for that old maybe salvation thing.
Yeah,
like with her being the virgin and shit.
It failed. But it was still enjoyable. Not to take too much away from it, because I did still really enjoy it. And when I revisited it most recently, like, I did still have an okay time with the movie. It wasn't like Near Dark, where it was like I hadn't seen it for 5 or 6 years, and I fired it up and was like, ugh! But, you know, it was still pretty entertaining for what it was. And, I mean, Jeffrey Combs was great. Oliver Reed in his all-too-brief appearance was great. And you know what? Unlike Andrew, I kind of dug Lance in it. As completely out to lunch as he was. And I mean, no doubt.
He had his moments. I got to say, okay, he had his moments.
He suited that character pretty well. I think it was more, I think Lance was kind of let down by the script more than his performance.
But I would have liked to see Stephen McHattie in that role.
Or Michael Wincott.
There we go. Now we're talking.
You just gave me the Ghiblies.
Andrew just got wood.
You need to write a movie. Just go to Michael Wincott.
May I have the pleasure of your name before I have you pendulumed? Might I have the pleasure of your name before I strap you to a table and lower a swinging blade across your gullet?
One more thing I gotta throw. This movie has one of the more, I have to say, you know, there. Every now and then you watch a movie, and right at the beginning, the main character does something. You're supposed to root for them, but they do something that kind of bugs you, and for the rest of the movie, you just can't really get behind them. This has one of the more interesting ones, because the main characters run a bakery, and there is a flagrant health code violation right at the beginning. I would not eat at that bakery because they were going at it on those bags of flour. If that bread wasn't burning, who knows what would have made its way into the next marble rye, for example.
Hey, it's the Middle Ages. I mean, there's probably rat poo in there anyways.
rodent surprise, guys. Come on.
1 in 9 loaves was considerably higher in protein than the rest.
Oh. And then the honeymoon was over.
All right, enough of this. What about you, John?
Oh, there can be only one. Fortress.
Woo!
Now, I'm not going to knock on Fortress too much. You know, on the one hand, it's executed with mild competence.
Action scenes, I got to say, for someone who does really shitty action scenes, Fortress wasn't...
This is probably the... You know, it's miles above Robot Jocks.
Oh, yeah.
this is probably some of the best action Gordon's done in his career. Especially if you saw the version with the giant truck at the end of it.
Oh, yes. I think that's all we saw being in Canada. I think that was the only version we had.
Yeah, I think so.
You mean the full movie?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. On the other hand, there's nothing, absolutely nothing, to separate Fortress from the rest of the sci-fi blasé that kind of settled over the 90s once Steven Spielberg moved on to more mature fare.
Oh, those screamers!
Spielberg was like the cool kid on the block, but once he said, I'm going to stop playing with G.I. Joes and start playing guitar, you know, the rest of the film world couldn't make that type of, you know, the 1980s feeling sci-fi anymore. It stopped being awesome. And, you know, you got stuff like Screamers, No Escape, Free Jack.
I got to say, for the record, I kind of love Screamers.
No, yeah, you probably love it for all the wrong reasons, like me.
Roy Dupuis?
Peter Weller hasn't stopped.
Roy Dupuis is awesome. Peter Weller.
But, I mean, Fortress has got the Clarence Boddicker himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Fortress, it's just, there's no heart to it, you know?
Fortress that has no sense to it. Nothing about this movie makes any sense.
You know, it's like in the 90s, they had the bread formula for making what they thought was cyberpunk, but wasn't. In a dark future where soft serve ice cream is outlawed, one man dared to champion frozen treats. Right? In a future where having babies is illegal, Highlander decided to have babies. Highlander decided he was going to screw his wife.
I love that they're trying to sneak through this, you know, super high-tech detection, like, roadblock thing.
That looks like a warehouse in downtown Vancouver.
And it's like, the one thing they point out is, like, make sure you don't let your collar go down too far, so they see the big, like, you know, U.S. property, U.S. Army on her flak jacket that blocks the scanner. And it's like, okay, if you know that that's right there, why would you not button up your shirt?
wasn't there, like, she's wearing a fucking flak jacket.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And for some reason,
what saves Fortress for me, and let's just get something out there. I hate Christopher Lambert. I really, really do.
He's not
the one of many.
The guy doesn't even have the redeeming cheese factor to him.
No.
It's just, he's terrible.
He's not Def Jon. How many times do I have to tell you?
He does not deserve a Quentin Tarantino career revival.
No, he does not.
When your best role is Lord Raiden in Mortal Kombat, I mean, you have a problem.
Screw you, hippie Connor McCloud.
Didn't we have Didn't we have a conversation months ago about how Highlander was actually awful and no one noticed?
Yeah. I still love it. I'm sorry.
Oh, so do I.
You have a movie
Fortress of Highlander made in 1992. Okay, Spielberg's already put away his G.I. Joes. It's not cool anymore. No, J.J. Abrams hasn't come along yet. Right? We're in a dark time now. It's a dark future, and you can't have any soft serve ice cream.
Or babies.
Or babies.
And Ronnie Cox will tell you.
Babies.
For some reason, each time I think of Fortress, I flash back to The Running Man. I don't know.
But man, no, getting onto what makes it not my ugly, outside of Christopher Lambert, it's saved by the cast.
Yeah.
You know, look, I'm pretty sure I saw Clifton Collins Jr. back in the days when he was Clifton Gonzalez. He's one of the greatest names I've ever heard. And, Red Foreman. Clarence Boddicker's in there.
You're going to be intestinated, dumbass.
Oh,
intestinate.
The intestinators.
Jeffrey Combs shows up, of course.
He does. Of course he does.
This was, when sci-fi was written sort of by, it was almost like Mad Libs, sci-fi-sounding stuff, and, hopefully nobody knows anything about technology.
What I thought was hilarious about it, they had this formula they went through for every single movie, and you just know that the guys thought when they were doing it that they were fucking making Blade Runner.
But at least I'd watch it over Virtuosity or that other picture.
You take that back. Virtuosity was awesome.
Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah, okay, now Johnny Mnemonic, okay, fine.
No.
Oh,
no,
serious?
I'm not soft for that, okay? Dolph Lundgren is the street preacher. Greatest casting ever.
But the dolphin with the telepathic helmet, John.
I wish to disassociate myself from this conversation.
Which one of
put a cyber brain in a dolphin.
Which one of those two had the Kashyyyk Kitano in it?
That was Johnny Mnemonic.
Okay.
And apparently the Japanese version has significantly more of him.
Apparently there was a considerably longer cut of that movie, like a 45-minute longer cut that was supposed to be pretty awesome.
Well, yeah, like Takeshi Kitano was like the star of it in Japan.
Yeah, like, you know what he should have been the star of it? Laser Thumb.
Laser Thumb.
And that'll tie into my ugly now in a couple of minutes.
I have one final thought on Fortress. Christopher Lambert has the coolest 90s action movie protagonist name ever.
John
Henry Brennick.
Riddick?
Brennick.
If anybody in history is not named Brennick in any universe, it is Christopher Lambert.
And yeah, that's like Colonel John Matrix from Wyoming.
You know what's also awesome?
I'm going to rescue Jenny.
No, he grew up in East Germany, and the Soviets thought rock and roll was subversive. Maybe they were right.
I forgot about...
The other awesome thing is when they're trying to cross a border at the beginning, they're trying to escape to Canada.
Here in Canada, you can have all the babies and ice cream you want.
Because we got the trees.
We got space.
All you got to do is get over the wall, ladies.
Just put on a flak jacket. Make sure none of the USGI types see it, because they're going to yell, "She's got a fucking flak jacket!"
And Herbert West is going to have to hack all sorts of computers. And Clifton Gonzalez is going to get run over by the truck for maximum overdrive.
and you're going to get intestinated.
Dumbass! Sayonara, John Henry Brennick.
So for my ugly, I chose Dolls.
Are we on ugly or are we... We're still bad.
Sorry, for my bad, sorry. I'm a terrible host.
Got ugly on the brain.
You're not terrible, Gabriel. You're French.
Snap!
No, I'm not saying that to be insulting. I mean, he can make all the mistakes he wants and just write them off. We'll all be like, man, he's so cool.
Exactly. He just, he says something.
I'll picture he read
John Mercer, and then he takes out a cigarette and smokes, and we're just like, fuck that guy.
Owned.
So for my bad, I chose Dolls. Dolls is a very peculiar picture. It's as if he was trying to make a grim fairy tale atmosphere, like to mix the horror and the fairy tale and childhood in it. But again, it just doesn't really work. I mean, it's got a cool atmosphere, and again, the cast is pretty good, especially his wife, which he often casts, Carolyn Purdy Gordon, who plays a total bitch in this movie.
That's a word that hates women, Gabriel.
Let's also get out of the way right away. It's better than Child's Play. And no one's agreeing with me.
Stunned silence.
Tom Holland is an artist, goddamn you.
It's better than Child's Play 3, I'll say that.
I just love that the end of Child's Play is the end of Terminator played back in miniature.
I kept watching Child's Play wondering when the cop was going to realize he was a vampire and just kick the shit out of Chucky.
Yeah.
So, but it's got, like, this weird morality thing that going, like, where the bad people get killed and turned into dolls by these weirdo doll makers. But that doesn't make any sense at all. Like,
but you know what? That's kind of like a perfect like late 30s or even like mid 30s to early 40s like horror premise.
Yeah.
Where it wasn't really explained, but you just have this guy who through the miracle of science had managed to turn evil people into dolls. Like, so that's the vibe I got.
it would have a more awesome name though in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, like I can't come up with anything. Dolls.
Death in Linen or something like that.
Maybe they could have made an Irish version and called it the Wee People.
Wee Creepin'.
Darby O'Gill and the Little People of Death.
But seriously, I don't really have much to say about it. I mean, the low budget is very apparent. Those two hitchhiker girls are pretty horrible. And so's the guy who has the kid inside of him, who just overplays it too much. I mean, the best thing going for it is pretty much the atmosphere and Carolyn Purdy Gordon, and that's about it.
It's a Charles Dolls. That means it's time for another drink.
Oh, Captain Morgan, where have you been all day?
And as we can hear right now, nobody else has lots of to say about Dolls, so let's move on to the ugly.
I'll add one final thought.
Okay.
Same thing I thought about Reanimator when I revisited it. Man, this is a dark-looking movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was
lots of gloomy shadow.
Yeah, really, really black film.
Seeps into all the cracks.
Yeah,
just not very good.
No.
So let's move on to which is sure to be a trial, the ugly of Stuart Gordon, and let's start right away with Mr. John Mercer.
Oh, I need to compose myself for a second. Last wine.
Just throw up on the mic.
Really? This is a Stuart Gordon podcast, John.
Yeah. I know, it's just revisiting this was like teabagging a blender.
Wine. We're not doing Melville this evening, John.
It gets me drunk faster. Robot jocks.
Oh, come on. Giant robots.
Yeah, no. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, listen. I'm a man of simple tastes, okay? I love Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone.
Because it's
awesome. I love Metal Storm. I love Megaforce and Gunhead and Deathstalker and that Hawaiian movie with the guy throwing the Razor Frisbee.
Hey, Kumeen!
You guys got a great ass. Yes, I like things like that. I was raised on 80s anime and old issues of Heavy Metal, and I love robots. If there was a single person in North America that Robot Jocks was aimed at in 89 and 90, whenever it came out, it was me. And even as an 8-year-old, that movie sucked. So bad. You know, it's like you've got robots, and we've talked about low budget. They could have afforded to make the robots have something other than cardboard.
Legos.
Yeah.
Made them out of
Legos. Legos would have been better. Legos, the acting is terrible. All those interesting shots we were talking about, and the Dutch angles and everything in Reanimator, and like the, the cool dark look of his movies and everything, that all gets flushed right down the crapper in RoboJocks. It's just, it's horribly acted, it's horribly written, it's an abortion from start to finish.
It's also from Trans World Pictures.
And I mean the you can tell that it was a troubled production. The way I felt when watching it, you can certainly feel a dichotomy where it, at the same time it's trying to be some kind of serious hard sci-fi movie, but at the same time it wants to be a goofy movie for kids.
Yeah, well, they got the scene where what was the Russian guy, Alexander?
Yeah,
fires the fist off of his idiot, his like stupid looking. Horrible effect shot of the fist flying towards the camera, and it's all seen from Achilles Mech's point of view, so you got all the crosshair that, that doesn't look as good as RoboCop moving around screen. And then you got, Achilles jumps in front of it to save the spectators, and then it hits him and knocks him back, and he crushes them all to death. And you got the, I don't even know who played Achilles, but he was terrible.
Achilles was played by Gary Graham, who I believe was the result of a three-way between Peter Gallagher, Dermot Mulroney, and Thomas Hayden Church.
And that's what it looks. It looks like Thomas Hayden Church's derpy little brother biting on his lower lip and trying to hold back his tears. When he looks down, then you get the gore shot of the 200 spectators. I think it's about 12 people on camera, and it's one of those sci-fi movies where everything looks like it's filmed on empty streets and empty sets, and the sets are all hotel rooms.
Like Time Cop.
Yeah, there's
like
there's
any,
nobody
like anything directed by, what was his name, Hyams?
Peter Hyams.
Peter Hyams.
Except for relatives.
Hey, the man's his own cinematographer. He's an artist.
Yeah, but all of his sets are empty.
Except Running Scared, because they didn't tell anyone
light
they're
filming and shadow, Steve.
Come on, End of Days is a classic.
Well, I will say, I love The Relic.
Christ in New York.
Listen, Peter Hyams' relevance is a genius, notwithstanding.
I can't keep a straight face there, I'm sorry.
So you're like Thomas Hayden Church's derpy little brother when he crushed four people.
Yeah,
you're sitting there on camera. Going
the thing that really kills RoboJocks for me is the space sequence at the end. Oh. I mean, that's just plain too much. Man, I was kind of enjoying it because of the cheese factor, and then when it gets into space and, oh, man, I just fast-forward to the ending.
War is outlawed. All conflicts are centered in the gladiatorial arena. what sort of man can survive in this horrible future of robot jocks?
I believe this is sort of one of the other parts of Stuart Gordon's What's Forbidden in the Future series. This time it's war. Before it was babies.
Yeah. It just... You know, you figure giant robots. It's like a hamburger. How do you mess that up?
It's kind of hard.
Yeah. You know, they definitely caught the fat on robot jocks.
But
they weren't, they weren't even cooking with meat. They were cooking with boxes. The same boxes they made the robots out of.
But I still think that Gordon was trying on that picture, you know? He tried to do something different.
Trying doesn't mean succeeding.
No, it's true. But, I mean, often our uglies are people who are, like, you know, it's like the Blues Brothers 2000. People don't even try to do a good picture, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to dive in. I'm just going to...
Yeah, I'm depressed. Let's move on.
I'm gonna usurp the order of battle and jump in after my fellow Newfoundlander.
Monster.
And I'm going to say my ugly is robot jocks.
Didn't you boo John?
Yeah,
when he said that his was robot jocks?
That was just to lull you all into a false sense of security before I drop the other shoe.
And again, this is coming from another person who probably loves Megaforce.
I you're goddamn right. Swish, Megaforce. I don't think there's a single movie by what was the director's name again?
Hal Needham.
Needham, yeah. I don't think there's a single movie by Hal Needham that I don't like.
Even Red?
I don't remember Red, but I own Stroker Ace and Smokey and the Bandit, okay? But, yeah, no, robot jocks. It could have been cool. It could have been really cool. And being a big Battletech nerd and Robotech nerd back when Robot Jocks was first released, it was all the talk, you know? It was popping up in a lot of the magazines and stuff like that. And it was forever before I finally found a copy of it. It was like, it felt like years after people were talking about it that it finally appeared.
And did you see the trailer on Firebirds?
Yeah. And I sat down to watch it, and man, was it ever boring. And I mean, this is from, 12, maybe 11 when Robot Jocks came out, and I was bored, senseless, watching a movie about giant robots beating the crap out of each other.
With rocket fists.
With rocket fists.
Rocket fists.
You know, like, John, you pretty much...
Because you weren't picking up on the compelling social commentary.
No, it was just, it was bad. It was awful. And... I will say, you know, like, it was, you want to see a good, cheesy, sci-fi, giant robot movie? Hop on YouTube and look up the live-action cutscenes from the original Heavy Gear video game for PC. You know, like, it's considerably better than Robot Jocks. That movie was just so ridiculously horrible. And I think, you know, the biggest thing, the one thing that always comes back to me, and this is like being a total sci-fi nerd, but I gotta go there, I'm sorry. But... what always comes back to me is if you're going to make a movie about giant robots, they got to have a really kick-ass cockpit. You know? You got to have a really cool-as-hell control setup. This has two guys standing in what looks like a locker room, metal pads under their feet.
It's like a cooperative sperm donor clinic.
They're in their ridiculous winter skidoo suits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah, sitting down at the gym at the Y.
Yep. It was just such a horrible, horrible movie. And there was a semi-official sequel called Robot Wars. Anyone remember that one?
No, but I do remember Crash and Burn, Robot Jocks 2.
I don't remember that.
Oh, was Robot Wars the one with James Remar?
I think so, and I know one of the robots was a big scorpion.
Terror.
Oh, you said the name of he who shall not be named.
What, James Remar?
After Warriors? Oh.
I don't know, man. I'd like to nail down some strange wool.
So,
I knew that was coming up.
I keep waiting for the episode when he tells that when he tells Dexter to soldier and should keep his mouth shut.
See, so, yeah, I mean, John, you already hit most of the same notes I wanted to hit, so I'm just going to leave it at that. Robot Jocks, man, what a shitty movie.
you want to see how you fuck up Shore Money? There you go.
At the height of the giant robot craze, too.
Yeah.
When you make a movie...
Was Starcom that much of a memory?
Did you guys know that Joe Alderman worked on the script?
What?
Yeah.
Yes, I knew about that.
Oh, my God. Why, Joe? Why have you forsaken me?
but he got into this huge battle with Gordon because Adelman wanted it to be the hard sci-fi thing and Gordon wanted to make a kid's picture.
Yeah.
And so inject his...
Guys, just a second. We live in a world where we can't get a movie made out of the Forever World. But Joe Haldeman can write the screenplay for Robot Jocks.
Somebody
else
with
go. We
need to stop talking about this movie.
Andrew, what's your ugly? Quick. Before they die.
Don't say Robot Jocks.
Robot Jerks. No. I'm going to have to pull us back to Fortress. I almost went for From Beyond, but honestly, Fortress is a significantly worse movie. We've already talked about, you know, the intestinations, Clifton Gonzalez.
Is that actually his name?
That's his
real name. That was his credited name.
I thought you were kidding. I thought you were being really racist.
His last name is Gonzalez, and his middle name is Gonzalez.
Oh, my God.
It's not even cute where they're spelled differently.
And Clifton is pronounced Speedy.
God damn it.
That part is a
lie. Does he not sound like he should be one of the Cosby kids?
Don't do that when I've got a gob full of liquor, please.
I don't think we mentioned that it has Tom Tolles in it.
That knocks it down a bit more.
and Vernon Wells, a.k.a. Let Off Some Steam Bennett.
Yeah. Doesn't he get, annihilated by a sentry turret?
Yes.
Yes, he does. He doesn't even get his chance to escape and recreate
the game.
it's a really weird scene when that happens because... you go from this strange situation where, you know, originally he just basically wanted to rape Christopher Lambert, and, you know, maybe back to second a bit. And then within the space of about 3 seconds, they have, this sort of, bonding moment, and then his chest explodes. But to be perfectly honest, it was the most believable dramatic moment I've seen Vernon Wells in. So I was all for it. But Fortress, yeah, it was like every half-ass sci-fi cliche that people who didn't actually like sci-fi would come up with in order to try to pander to an audience. That's how it felt to me.
For God's sakes, man, the tagline is "Welcome to the Future."
Yeah.
Yeah. How much more ham and egg or Charlie Punch Clock can you get?
What was the name of the guys they send after him? It was another one of those horrible mashup portmanteau sci-fi words
strike clones.
Strike clones. Send in the strike clones.
That's almost as great as Z10. I just love that, you know, John Henry Brennick and his wife Karen are attempting to cross the border into Vancouver, ironically, where the movie was filmed. And they hijack a truck and escape to Mexico, Calgary.
I thought those desert sequences looked familiar.
They escaped to Red Deer.
They couldn't even afford to film in Calgary.
Well, I'll take Andrew's cue and I'll go with From Beyond as my ugly.
Hooray, I'm not alone.
Basically, they tried to capitalize on Reanimator and took the same team, exactly the same thing, and tried to do a more serious kind of Lovecraft adaptation, but with the same kind of humor, but not as well put in the movie. Gordon doesn't have a handle on the tone that he wants to do in this flick. I mean, it's either way too serious or way too goofy or way too uneasy, freakish sexuality. There's an awful scene with like this guy who's only wearing like underpants and like tight underpants, and he's in the water. I mean, I can't erase it from my mind. I mean, this guy's in his red clingy underpants, and he's fighting a giant snake. it's terrible. And every time the scientific guy comes up, I don't remember his name. The guy dies at the beginning and comes back from beyond.
Oh yeah.
Pretorius.
Every time that guy shows up, he just kills the movie with his hammy acting and the makeup, which is way too much. I mean, it's nicely done, but it's way too much makeup. And the way that like the weird sexuality is mixed in, it almost makes me feel as if like Gordon was trying to make like a Cronenberg picture and totally failing at it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it didn't help that his lead character was played by Barbara Crampton, and she was supposed to display more than mild confusion throughout the movie. Like, she's not exactly a...
Well,
actor?
She's got talent when she's naked, basically.
because we've spoke about the Strike clones and... Three Agent and Z-10. What was the device called in From Beyond? The MacGuffin that gave them all crazy doom vision?
Yeah. Oh,
the resonator. The resonator.
The pineal gland resonator.
Yeah. I mean, there's still some good scenes. I mean, I really like that scene when they get combs in the hospital near the end and, like, Carolee Purdy Gordon finds him eating on a brain.
It helps that, like, you know, you've finally got Combs playing, like, completely batshit again, and he's in this awesome, like, bald makeup with, like, the Daryl Revick drill hole.
Yeah.
In his forehead.
I mean, again, Combs probably saves this picture, and despite showing a non-comfortable amount of flesh, Ken Foree isn't too bad either.
Ken Foree is a legend.
It's one of those movies.
But he does play a character named Bubba.
Bubba Brownlee.
It's one of those movies, like, I don't really hate it, and I couldn't really call it my ugly. That was obviously Robot Jocks, but it's one of those flicks that when people, you know, these certain cults who are aware of his existence talk about Stuart Gordon, From Beyond is always one of the movies that pops up. It's always one of the ones that people talk about. And I can't...
As a good one.
I can't understand for the life of me why.
Yeah, no. Me neither. I mean, I jump on, like, King of the Ants before I talk about From Beyond.
The thing with From Beyond, I mean, the way it's set up, you think there's going to be some, like, really interesting ideas explored in it.
Yeah.
And it really isn't at all. It's
it never
kind of
goes
like,
anywhere.
Oh,
it's just
it's like
kinda...
we turn this on and we get horny and sometimes spirit eels bite our
and it's like it changes in a different movie every 10 minutes, basically.
Yeah, that too. You know, and characters are totally inconsistent. Barbara Crampton's character honestly made no sense to me.
No, at one point she's like this like shy but intelligent psychiatrist, and then she gets turned, like, her pineal gland transforms her into an S&M dominatrix, and after that...
and then a wannabe supervillain.
I mean, that's the only point where, like, the movie really piqued my interest. I was like, Barbara Crampton, S&M outfit, I'm in.
I gotta tell you guys, you just described what I wanted Altered States to be.
Oh, Altered States is a much better movie.
It is.
Oh. You know, if they could have gotten Jeffrey Combs to play Barbara Crampton, if he was Dr. Catherine McMichaels,
I couldn't
would have been a better movie.
I'm not sure I could handle Jeffrey Combs in an S&M getup.
It definitely would have been more horrifying.
It definitely would have been more memorable.
I'm not sure that Lovecraft would have approved.
I don't know, man. Sure he's a pretty freaky cat.
Maybe.
Well, wasn't he, like, some kind of closet gay?
No, but he was a white supremacist and a Hitler supporter.
Okay.
Gosh, come on. The man was depressed.
That's kind of oversimplifying.
I thought there was shadiness about this sexuality as well. But
he was very repressed. He was ill when he was young, so he didn't travel very much. He was, I think, a bit socially awkward.
He had a wife who basically carried him using her like inheritance or whatever. But they had very, very, very little in terms of relations. Like, they didn't really interact with one another.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the guy dreamt up the elder gods. I mean, how much of a social life can he have?
It's kind of funny. Another little bit of Lovecraft trivia, like, kind of on topic, I guess. But the whole Cthulhu mythos wasn't actually...
Yeah, it was all created after his death,
it was all August Derleth, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. But yeah, now we better wrap up, and I'll take your opinions about Stuart Gordon in general, and whoever wants to go first, just go.
It's me.
Okay, go.
All right. Stuart Gordon. You know, I have an affection for the guy. Again, like, I think, you know, we've mentioned throughout the thing, he's obviously a guy who puts a lot of love into his movies. He loves what he does. But I don't think, even, you know, he swings for the fences, but he's not holding a bat some of the time. Like, he's just, he's had a couple of good movies, but mostly I think his output has been pretty inconsistent and goofy when it should be horrifying. But at the same time, he's more successful than I am, so that's why I'm talking about him.
Well put.
Also Reanimator.
I think technically speaking, he's a solid director. He really is, you know, he knows how to put together a film, but I think a lot of the time, or at least the impression I get, is his ambitions are outstripped by his capabilities and outside interference.
Mm-hmm.
I think very few of his films are really uncompromising films. I really think that, like, given the opportunity to go totally unbridled, to really just flex his little imagination muscles and just run wild, I think he would have an absolutely brilliant horror film in him.
I think he just had the highest budget hentai of all time.
I mean, you can tell a Stuart Gordon picture pretty much right away.
Yeah.
When you start watching it, he definitely has a recognizable style.
As long as he sticks to horror and doesn't try science fiction, you know.
Space truckers.
Pretty enjoyable.
Space truckers.
We didn't talk about space truckers.
I don't want to talk about space truckers.
So what about you, John? Final thoughts on Gordon?
I often sit back and I think about, because Gordon, you know, I've heard him so many times compared to Sam Raimi, and I often sit down and wonder what would have happened if Gordon had had his little dalliance with the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
What type of filmmaker he would have. He could have been. Again, you know, this is a guy who is surprisingly good outside of Robot Jocks at masking a very low budget. You know, this is, and that's something can be said about a lot of guys who got their start in horror. And, you know, he's done some stuff that I like. He's, you know, like, I loved Reanimator. I really did, and that was... You know, for a while there, I thought back and thought it might have been nostalgia, but after going back and watching it recently, I really did enjoy it. But like you said, Andrew, he's far too inconsistent, and, you know, there's definitely, when you look at his filmography, there's definitely more bad than there is good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's a horrible thing to say, but there are, you know, Gordon's position as a filmmaker is exactly proportionate to his talent as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
But right? As I said in my introduction, ever since Dagon, I think you can really see him growing as a filmmaker and trying to be more serious and to do, I qualify like his output since Dagon as basically existentialism, yeah. More or less. It's very, very dark, even more so than before. Empire of the Ants, as I said, is basically nihilistic, and Edmund is also very dark, even for Mammoth Play. And Stuck, well, it's pretty unconventional.
Stuck was a pretty bleak flick, too.
Yeah, it's very bleak, and also very, I mean, he's still trying to do different stuff, you know? He's still not really conforming to any set rules.
And coming back to what John said, I gotta say, you know, to say, you know, maybe what would have happened if Gordon had his shot at the mainstream... To his credit, I would say, I don't think he could exist in the mainstream.
No.
Despite the fact that, as we've mentioned, you know, his films have had to compromise on a number of things, I don't think he's ready to compromise on the types of stories he's interested in. And I don't think that those are ever going to have a tendency to cross over into the...
I mean, you
mainstream.
Can't. I can't see him doing Spider-Man. You know.
No. And I mean, like, does Stuart Gordon really have? You know, like, I look at Cronenberg or I look at Sam Raimi, and does Stuart Gordon really have? You know, a history of violence or A Simple Plan in him? You know, can he make that kind of a film? You know.
I mean, the nearest he's gotten is Edmund. I mean, that got some good reviews in the normal press, but
It's one of those things, Edmund and
King of the Ants.
King of the Ants, yeah. Like Edmund and King of the Ants are two movies that, you know, when I hear Stuart Gordon's name, I think I immediately dart to Reanimator. You know, I immediately go to Reanimator or Dagon or Pit and the Pendulum. Like I don't equate those movies with Gordon. Like I know we were talking about it a few weeks ago when we decided Gordon was going to be our next discussion topic. I didn't even realize Stuck was a Stuart Gordon film.
Hmm.
You know, it was when we talked about doing Gordon and I brought up the IMDb and I was like, holy crap, he directed Stuck?
I think you can still see his dark humor in there, you know? You can still see his kind of worldview and his style, too, that pops up in all of those movies.
I will say it was pretty dark looking.
Yeah.
And there's some pretty crazy, dark gallows humor.
Yeah, yeah.
In all of those, too. And also the proof that when he has an actor that's actually good to start with.
Yeah.
And that doesn't need much directing, like Edward Macy, like Macy, you know? Macy was the bomb in Edmund.
Yeah. That was a really great movie.
Yeah.
Good enough for us to have discussed it at length.
I probably should have chosen it as my good, actually.
Yeah,
but...
objectively speaking, I probably would have had to pick it. Like if I were going more for just in general, I might have taken it as my good. But again, when I think Stuart Gordon, I immediately think, you know, Lovecraft adaptations and all that. So I jumped to Dagon, you know?
It's probably but it's not my favorite.
And we have to remember that Gordon also directed some Mammoth plays when he was doing theater.
Yeah.
So I guess on that note, does anybody else have something to say, or shall we say goodbye until next Wednesday?
Next Wednesday, when we will be discussing one of our first real heavy hitters, I think, in terms of name recognition.
And our first Canadian.
Our first Canadian director. And David Cronenberg has come up a couple of times in this discussion, so tune in.
If you have a fetish for the gruesome, David Cronenberg next Wednesday.
Bring your chest vaginas.
See you next Wednesday. All right, I hit stop.